So guys, welcome along to the Diabetes Chat. This week we have Noah, who is our guest speaker. Noah was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes almost 20 years ago, back in 2003, when he was in 8th grade, which is year 9 in the UK, I believe. Noah is a writer, actor, most known for his role in playing Rin in Star Trek Discovery in the 3rd series. So any Star Trek fans out there, I'm sure you'd be excited to see Noah here this evening. Noah is married to Discovery actress Mary Wiseman and has been married since 2019, and they also met at drama school. And Noah is part of a very exciting upcoming short film about diabetes, set during a global disaster, and this evening Noah will explain a little bit about that as the evening goes on. So welcome along, Noah. I've done a bit of homework, and hopefully I've done you justice already.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Am I coming through all right?
Yes. How are you, mate?
Good. I'm great. Super excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Honestly, it's really cool that you've been able to come along this evening and chat with the Diabetes Chat community. There's so many great listeners who are in tonight who I know the last couple of weeks have been super excited. I know Janina's there and in New Zealand, and I know it's very early over there. But yeah, she's really excited for you to be here. But so thank you so much for coming on. So the course of the evening, guys, we're going to have a chat with Noah, and he's going to hopefully answer some of our questions. But if you guys want to get involved, that's what it's all about. We're live here, so you can tweet us Diabetes Chat or press the blue button at the bottom, and you can send a question or a thought to what Noah's maybe said, or you can request to speak, and we can get you onto the panel, and you can join myself, Morgan, Chris, Norman and James there at the minute, and you can ask some questions throughout the chat or at the end if you've got any questions as well. Does that sound all right, guys? Noah?
Sounds great to me. I mean, I hope I can live up to the intro and the excitement, but I'll do my best, I promise.
I'm sure you will. So what I thought is, I don't know if you've seen, and I don't know if a couple of guys have seen this week. Last week, we did a new feature on a Diabetes Chat, which is a 90-second question, quick-fire round of questions. Well, I'll ask some questions, and basically, it's just as quick as you can, just kind of respond to it, just a couple of words and whatnot. And then what I'll do is I'll put it together as a video, and we'll upload that on our social media platforms. Are you ready for the game? Are you up for the game?
I'm ready. I'm glad that right at the top, we're just going to get all my hot takes out and all my bad takes and my thoughtless takes. So let's get them out of the way early. I think that's
brilliant stuff. Let's go. What's your full name?
Samuel Noah Max Aberback Cat.
What is your occupation?
I am an actor, writer, you know, all around nerd.
What year were you diagnosed and how old were you?
2003, I just turned 13.
What is your favorite hypo treatment?
My favorite hypo treatment is ice cream. It's also the least effective.
Do you use insulin pens or pump?
I use pens. And I have a Dexcom CGM.
What's worse, feeling hypo or hyper?
I gotta say, for me, it's worse being hyper high, because I get so angry, so frustrated, that I just hate it.
What three symptoms do you have when you have hypos?
Super hungry, got lightheaded, light body feeling, and get grumpy as well.
When you finger prick, do you change your lancets every day?
Are you kidding me? Is that a joke? No, I think I changed my lancet in 2014, and it was a big day.
One thing you like about your diabetes?
It's a great way to get anybody to like you.
One thing you don't like about your diabetes?
Just one? My goodness. I hate the relationship it puts you in with food.
Do you love or hate the smell of insulin?
I'm pretty agnostic to the smell of insulin. I think one thing that I do like about the smell of insulin is when I was using a pump, if the set came out, you can really smell it. So it's almost like the gas in the stove, you know? So I appreciate that it has a smell.
So what we'll do is we'll head over to Chris, and he's going to talk a little bit about your sort of background to diabetes and where it all began.
Sure.
Hey, Noah, how's it going?
It's going really well, Chris. It's great to finally get to talk to you. I really appreciate all the work you've done, and I really appreciate seeing all these posts with complicated math and things that I look at and I say, thank God somebody understands that, because I really don't. So I appreciate all of that.
Well, the ultimate goal is to teach a computer to do it, so you don't have to think about it.
That's what I'm here for, man. That's why I'm so appreciative. Thank God.
I actually listened to your interview with Stacy Sims, again, getting ready for this. So actually, before I jump into this, I feel like I have to ask, since you told her that you were planning on starting filming this month, is that still on track?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Shooting starts on the 12th. We travel to the location on the 11th. So literally, before I hopped on here, I was, you know, sitting at my computer, firing off all these emails, making sure everything's in place. And then once I finish up, I'll get right back on the computer and just keep chugging away at this thing. Yeah, because we will travel on the 11th, shoot 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, wrap on the 15th, and travel back on the 16th.
Wow, that's a really compressed schedule.
It really is, man. It really is.
All right. Getting into sort of your diabetes background, sort of getting to know you stuff, you mentioned being diagnosed at about 13 in the eighth grade.
Yes.
So what was your initial reaction to being diagnosed? How did you feel at the time?
You know, it was interesting. I feel like actually 13, that transition period in the States from middle school to high school, actually wound up being a very good time to be diagnosed, at least for me, because it was already a transition period. Things were already changing. Everybody is like reestablishing a new identity as you move to this like another level of sort of semi-adulthood. And so I was lucky to be able to like incorporate the sort of diabetes thing into my new identity. I would imagine somebody who is diagnosed in their 20s or 30s or 40s or beyond, I can imagine how challenging it would be to suddenly have to redefine your identity and your personality and your relationships with this new thing dropped in the center. That said, you know, it was a real bummer. Instead of going to London for a vacation, we went to a diabetes summer camp. And then, you know, it took me about 3 or 4 months of sort of sporadically going to school before I really felt confident enough and in control enough to really start living my life again. I remember at the time, it was when Hey Ya and that Kylie Minogue video and Toxic by Britney Spears were all on MTV, and I probably saw, and I Believe in a Thing Called Love by the Darkness. So I saw those four videos on MTV probably 1500 times.
Wow. It was long enough ago that MTV was still actually playing music videos, huh?
Hard to believe, right?
Any memorable moments from that time, like a first hypo or, you know, getting yourself psyched up to do injections or anything like that?
You know, nothing much sticks out. I think my experience of diabetes camp, sort of being a preteen, moving into teen and independence, was, you know, the experience at that particular camp was very like communal, very like we're doing this together. It was very useful for my parents. And obviously there's a huge benefit in diabetes camp. And for me at the time, I just really couldn't stand, and honestly, it's kind of my personality. You know, I couldn't stand people doing things for me or being told what to do. And I remember there was all this hoopla around, you know, giving yourself your own shot, which I understand is like obviously extremely important, especially depending on where you're at. But for me at that time, I was like, you know what? I don't want to do this. I'm tired. So I like just sort of grabbed the needles, grabbed the vial, and just was like, listen, we're not doing this. I'm injecting myself. I'm done. We're going home. And so that was sort of a moment where I was like, that moment of realization where it's like, oh, you know, this is on me. You know, I am going to have to take care of myself and take care of this. And the sooner I can get get my mind wrapped around that, the sooner I'll be able to live the life that I really want to be living.
I think that makes sense. I can actually agree with and identify with a lot of that. I actually was diagnosed freshman year of college, so it was in the middle of a transition too, and a bigger one than the eighth grade to high school.
Definitely a bigger one. Yeah, definitely.
What are you using insulin wise? Are you on one of the newer basals and the super ultra rapid fast acting ones now, or?
I have the Fiasp. I use Humalog and I use Trajejo. I used the Fiasp for a little bit, and I actually found that in my mind, I wanted the Fiasp to work faster than it really does, you know? And so I found myself not giving myself actual pre-boluses so that the Fiasp could work. And I just sort of downgraded myself back to the Humalog because I at least knew, okay, you actually have to pre-bolus. You actually have to give the time. It's not just going to work like magic. So I have it available, but I'm still kind of that standard thing. Just that's where I sort of am the most comfortable right now.
Gotcha. You've mentioned that you used a pump in the past, but you're not currently. Is that correct?
That's right.
What was involved in the decision to go back to using pens or multiple injections rather than sticking with the pump?
I got so tired of losing days to a kinked cannula or to a set that didn't sit right with, you know, that didn't take, or just a set that took, you know, 8 hours to warm up. Sometimes it takes a while for them to start working properly. And I just found myself really appreciating the security that I got from manually delivering, you know. I knew it was in. There was no mistake. There was no question. There was no sort of anxiety about what the problem was, you know. It was either, you know, if I'm high, there's a very clear reason why it's happening. And, you know, back even in 2015, when I was last using a pump, like, there was no closed loop, really. There was looping, but there wasn't, like, you know, Control IQ, and Omnipods were just sort of becoming prevalent and weren't really most people didn't use them. And obviously so much has changed, like the technology has changed so much. So I'm actually a bit of a Luddite now. I'm actually like kind of way behind the times, but I find that the security I get with just knowing that it's in, knowing what's going on, is really beneficial to me and my care.
I think everybody can kind of identify with that. I know I resisted going on a pump for quite a while just because I knew that when I gave myself an injection that I was actually getting that insulin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Any big up and down moments, any sort of, you know, huge challenges that popped up or anything along the way as you've sort of navigated this journey so far?
You know, I feel like I've had a very lucky journey. I've never been insulin insecure. I've obviously had my moments of terror, you know, when I sort of dabbled in Afrezza for a while, and that was so fast acting that it really put me in danger a couple of times. I've been in that situation many times when you're going low and there's not a piece of candy in sight and you're on the road or something. But in general, I have been very fortunate to not have found myself in a truly, truly dire situation, either because I couldn't access insulin or because I couldn't get carbohydrates. So, you know, nothing huge sticks out, and I feel very thankful for that.
Okay.
Noah, may I ask you a question?
You may.
Have you ever, you've mentioned, I think you've kind of answered my question, but have you ever had a low sugar in your sleep that you didn't wake up from, you know, something that required like an ambulance or a hospital treatment?
No, I've never had the glucagon. I've never had to go to the hospital. I feel like I'm a very light sleeper and I find myself waking. I wake up when I go low, which I'm very, very lucky to have that experience. But I've certainly woken up many times, you know, on the brink, I would say, many, many times. So I think it's just I've gotten lucky with nighttime awareness, you know, and lucky in general.
I'm glad.
Thanks. Yeah, but you know, it's one of these things where it just feels like luck. There's nothing special in my care. There's nothing special I'm doing. You know, I'm sure people who work much harder than me to stay in range, to stay safe, have just had dumb luck accidents, and I just haven't.
All right. Thanks for that question, Norman, by the way. Last question for me is, what do you wish you'd known when you were first diagnosed?
Oh, my God. There's so much. You know, back in 2003, it feels like a whole generation ago. You know, small things about, like, just knowing that there were different care options than the one I was presented with. You know, I spent years with a hypodermic needle and a vial when pens were available. And I have no idea why these options weren't offered to me. Stuff about how going high affects your mood, how diabetes affects your mood. You know, I think anybody who sort of was diagnosed in the aughts always heard you can eat what you want, you can do whatever you want. And the lack of nuance in that obviously caused a lot of problems. There was no concept of pre-bolusing, or at least it wasn't, you know, in the circle. So sort of all of these things that I'm using now to manage, to stay in range, but also to like manage my mental health and how the physical symptoms of diabetes can really affect your mental health and just your mental well-being. I think I really wish that could have been addressed sooner, because I look back at times in my life when I was in an argument I couldn't get out of, you know, in like a professional argument, or when I would go into a situation with a group of people and some people would really like me, but other people would think I was a massive asshole and I didn't really think I was behaving so crazy. And I look back on that and I say, oh, I was just really, I was running at 250 for 2 weeks. You know, of course I was a jerk. Of course I couldn't let an argument go.
Noah, what's the best thing that's been in your life to do with diabetes? Like the best advancement, whether it be, you know, technology, different pens, that's affected you the most in a good way?
I would say it's a couple of things. I think the first thing recently, like being on a CGM within the past few years, has made a huge difference. It's allowed me to really pre-bolus. It's allowed me to kind of understand, to connect emotional experiences or mental experiences with high blood sugars. So I know, okay, if I'm feeling this way and I'm high, maybe the problem isn't that I am angry. Maybe the problem is that I'm high. I think that has really helped me survive. I think being connected to community, like we're doing here, and like I know everybody on this chat is a part of, has, it makes you able to care for yourself, because the isolation, the loneliness, the pressure, and the unrelentingness of being type one can, you know, obviously really affect your care. It can, you know, make burnout a real thing. And so really engaging in small ways and big ways with community, with other people to relieve a bit of that pressure and that stress, I think has also been a really, really important thing when it comes to type one.
That just explained probably half of what goes on in my life.
I got a question on a diabetes chat from Dre. I get grumpy when high too. Would have been super nice to know more about the mental effects too. How does Noah deal with emotions when sugars are high?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think the first thing is you have to recognize it, right? You have to know, okay, I'm grumpy and I'm high, right? If you don't know that, it really just does feel like you are angry. And so first off, recognizing the symptoms, really, you know, making sure you know what's happening, making sure you're checking your CGM, or if you don't have a CGM, you're doing a lot of finger sticks to get a lot of sort of emotional data about that stuff, makes a huge difference. So that way, when, you know, somebody cuts you off in traffic, or when your friend says something, that you can take a moment, do sort of a body check in and say, am I high, or did that actually upset me? And then the second thing is just to separate the feelings you feel when you're high, the anger, the frustration, the physical sensation from who you are. It's almost like you have to disassociate and say, look, this is not who I am. I'm not an angry person. I'm not a frustrated person. I'm having a diabetic symptom right now. And I just have to wait and be patient and distract myself and not, I don't want to say indulge, but not give myself triggers to increase the stress, to, you know, engage with the stress. And it's really challenging because sometimes those highs last for hours and hours and hours. And it's so frustrating to lose hours of your day. But sometimes it's worth it to remind yourself that that's not who you are. That's a symptom of your illness.
Great answer. I hope that's really helpful. Dre, on the hashtag there, buddy. Let's rewind the time a little bit before we head over to Morgan to maybe talk a little bit about your Star Trek background and how you deal with your diabetes and manage your diabetes there. Obviously, you talked about briefly your diabetes summer camp. Let's rewind a little bit. Obviously, you went to diabetes camp. What was diabetes camp? And was it for you? Was it for your parents? A bit of both? Yeah. Could you maybe enlighten us a bit about the experience? Obviously, maybe you were frustrated at the time, but yeah, could you share your moment there and what the whole thing is?
Absolutely. You know, I obviously like have a very skewed perspective of somebody who had maybe been diagnosed weeks before, who was on his summer vacation still as a kid. So to feel like you're losing summer vacation, that you're away from your friends, obviously feels, you know, like a huge loss when you're a kid. But obviously now, as I sort of have a bigger view, I can see how important these summer camps can be for people. So it's just my experience as a 13-year-old. I think it was a huge experience for my parents. You know, I think they were freaking out. They were absolutely had no idea what was going on. You know, there wasn't really an internet back then for them to like figure out or engage with the community or understand. We didn't know anybody who had this, you know, so it really helped them feel like I wasn't just going to, you know, turn into dust one day and blow away in the wind. So I think it was very helpful for them. And, you know, what I wanted, I just wanted to be 13. I wanted to play football. I wanted to go hang out at the movie theater. And I didn't really want to be a part of I wasn't ready to be a part of a real diabetes community yet, because I have no idea what it meant to be diabetic yet. You know, I really was at such an early part of my journey that the sort of connection and community I think somebody might feel by going to a summer camp again and again and again, I just wasn't ready for, because I didn't feel a part of the community yet, because it was all so fresh. But what I did, and I sort of said this before, but what I did take away from it was that if I wanted to do the things I wanted to do, even as a 13-year-old, that meant I had to get behind the wheel of this thing and be the one driving it. Because otherwise, my parents were going to have to follow me around. The nurse was going to have to follow me around. And it didn't just mean, you know, half-assing it or, you know, not really paying attention, but in order to get my parents off my back, they had to feel like I knew what the hell I was doing and that I was actually as, or if not more competent as them at handling it, so that they, you know, weren't in a panic all the time whenever I went out to, you know, go see Ice Age 2 at the movie theater or whatever.
What sort of tips and advice would you then maybe give maybe a parent with a child with diabetes?
You know, I one of my wife cousins, their kid just got diagnosed. Their kid's a lot younger, but I think they were really scared that the life that they knew was 100% over, you know what I mean? And that their kid was a whole new kid all of a sudden. And I think, you know, I think what my parents did really well was manage their stress and manage their anxiety and not dump it onto me. And I think that's sort of the main thing I talk to with parents when I do talk to them, is like, you know, how you respond to your kids' blood sugars, how you model behavior, how you, the relationship you have with it is going to be the relationship they have with it. So if you're panicking, if you're freaking out, if you see numbers as a judgment call, if you see them as good or bad and not as arbitrary indicators of like internal processes, then your kid's going to see that and they're going to hide it from you, you know? So it's not really having to do with camp, but I feel like that's what a lot of parents want to do. They want to control, they want to fix, you know, and that's just not the way. And you kind of have to let your kid grow up a little bit faster than you wanted them to. And then the other thing I always try to do is push parents off of a cure. Parents always get obsessed with a cure because they want their kid back. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with a cure. That's not really it. But I think it stops them from accepting the reality that this is here to stay. This is the way things are. This is your life now. And you need to kind of dig into that and not constantly be looking for someone to save you and give you your old kid back.
And like you said, it's looking at what you can do to manage your diabetes here and now. And then hopefully as a 13-year-old or whatever, is that you can still do the things that a 13-year-old can do. You know what I mean? Like you said, when you were diagnosed, you wanted to carry on playing football or doing this, doing that. And it's probably them sort of things, isn't it?
Final just question. To be clear, that is American football, not English football.
Absolutely. why is peer support so important to you? And what's your views on it? And what is so important about connecting with others? What do you take away from that?
I think it was what I was saying. You know, it's just a really lonely disease. And it's really hard for somebody who's not inside it to understand just how much work it takes. It's exhausting, it's unyielding, it's never ending. And the only person, you know, and I know I have a great partner, and I know lots of people with amazing, amazing care partners who provide so much, but there is just something about knowing that this other diabetic truly knows every second, you know, what you're thinking about it. You're doing calculations that are just in your head. And so feeling like you're not going through this alone, feeling like you're not crazy or doing something wrong for the way you're sort of engaging with this thing, I think it can just really take a weight off your shoulders. And when there's so much weight on there already, when your literal life hangs in the balance every single day, even a little bit off of your plate, off of your emotional load, can just make such a huge difference.
That's huge, mate, honestly. And I think it goes back to what you said before a little bit, was it takes time for people to accept this or acknowledge it and maybe reach out to either peer support or, like you said about the diabetes camps, you're like, oh no, yeah, I'm on my vocation. And you're not in that mindset. It takes people time. And
it took me years and years to reach out, because there is this other strange thing, which is that you have to work so hard and you have to sort of build up all these personal systems, you know, how you make this work for you, and they're so tenuous, these sort of survival techniques are so tenuous that there is a fear if you reach out to somebody that they're going to say, what are you doing? And then they're going to shatter your survival techniques, and then you're just out at sea, you know? So there is a real fear about connecting with other diabetics. There's a real risk that the things, the very tenuous things you hang on to try and stay alive might be taken away from you. But generally, instead, you'll actually gain something from that instead.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I agree with that 100%. Right. Noah, what we're going to do is Morgan's going to chat a little bit about your Star Trek background and how you sort of manage your diabetes with being a super actor. Over to you, Morgan.
Hello, hello.
Hi, Morgan. How are you?
I'm doing very good. Thank you for coming on and talking with us. This has been amazing so far. I'm eating up every word.
My pleasure.
I have to confess, I did, and I went on your IMDb page and the Star Trek page, you know, just scoping it out. I am a little IMDb obsessed, so. But
okay, good.
Let's, I guess, kind of, you know, get into it.
Sure.
So, with, obviously, you know, we have to talk about Star Trek. So with that, like, going into it, were you already a fan of Star Trek before you decided to audition and
I grew up going to Star Trek conventions with my mom. There are, if you go in my Twitter and you see at the top, it's like a pinned video of me as a 12-year-old at Star Trek conventions. So I have been a Star Trek fan my whole life. It's a very important thing for my mom. It's something we share. And when my wife Mary got on the show, it was massive. You know, it was a huge deal. And I was so excited just to get to, you know, be behind the scenes. It's every fan's dream. You know, I'm sure everyone here has a fandom that they're obsessed with, and they dream about what it would be like to, you know, go behind and meet everybody. And I got to do it. So it was really thrilling.
That is so cool. Yes, I also have those shows and like fandoms I'm in where I would literally give anything just to be there for a day of filming, just to be an extra. I would give like my left pinky to be an extra.
That is exactly it. And that's basically exactly what I got to do.
Which is absolutely incredible. So how did it work out that you were able to get on the show?
So it's a bit of a long story, but essentially one of the first times I was up on set, I was trying to show everybody on set pictures of me at Star Trek conventions because I was so excited. And everyone was really stressed out because it was like their second or third day shooting. And they were like, please leave me alone. I don't know who you are. I don't even know who your wife is. Like, stop talking to me. But I found this one guy and I was talking to him and he whipped out his phone and he started showing me pictures of him as a kid at Star Trek convention in the 70s. And this guy was Akiva Goldsman, who was one of the producers of the show. He was like, oh, we got to get you on as an extra, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was talking to him and there was like sort of an after party. And I was just, you know, we were going back and forth, trading all these Star Trek experiences. And he was like, look, if you really want to get on the show, you need to talk to this guy. Pointed to the guy sitting across from him, who is Alex Kurtzman, who is like the Star Trek head honcho guy, creative guy. And Alex was like, oh, it's nice to meet you, da da da. I don't even think me and Mary were married at that point. So I was basically, you know, somebody's boyfriend who was just there. And he was like, oh, I'm sure you're an actor. And as I was talking to him, this woman came over to me who I'd never met before. And she goes, I know you. And I thought, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. Like, I'm a total nobody here. I've never done anything. There's no way anybody here would know me. And I said, you know, you don't know me. And these two producers are looking on sort of embarrassed for me. And she's like, no, I know you. And I'm like, you really don't. And she's like, no, you were on the good fight on CBS All Access. And I was like, oh, yeah, I was on CBS All Access, which is now Paramount Plus, before there was any Star Trek on there. And in that moment, both of these producers, this particular Alex, was like, oh, he is a real actor. He was on this channel already. And so that sort of like, you know, got me on their radar. And then from there, I auditioned for a couple of roles. And finally, this one came down. I was in Toronto. I was living in Toronto with Mary. I flew down to New York. I auditioned. I flew back up. And then a few days later, they were making my head cast for my prosthetic.
How cool is that? Talk about it like at the right time.
Exactly. Really.
That is so cool. Okay. So, wow. That just like, I get all the pieces falling into place.
That's blown your mind, hasn't it, Morgan? I can hear it.
Listen, it's the only time I've successfully networked anything in my life, but I'm very proud of it.
Well, you should be. So can you tell us a little bit about your character and like what we might expect?
Yeah, so he was on season 3. Mm-hmm. He's like an Andorian, which is a blue alien who, you know, is trying to do the right thing, kind of beaten down, and he sort of has like a mini redemption arc before he something happens to him, which is bad. No spoilers.
Yes, for those who haven't seen it. So were you able to, I guess, connect with the character? Did you notice any, like, similarities between you and the character, or, you know, extreme differences?
Gosh, you know, when you're playing an alien like that, and you're wearing this big full mass prosthetic, and there's fireballs going off, and, you know, there's 150 people running around, you don't even think about, am I like this guy? Am I not like this guy? You're really just thinking like, okay, I'm actually here in space on this work camp. And if I get too close to this thing, this fireball is going to melt this plastic to my face. And if I don't get here in time, the, you know, the taskmaster of the work camp or the director is going to yell at me, and I'm afraid he's going to yell at me. So I better do it. So it really just felt like it was just me trying to survive in the most realistic way possible.
Yeah, but that's like, either way, it's incredible. I mean, like, I can't imagine, like, being on a set, like, having those, I mean, those prosthetics feel like, I feel like they'd be so, like, difficult to maneuver around, and
they are.
It just looks so natural when you watch stuff like that on screen, and then you, like, sometimes fire is real, sometimes it's not, like put in after, I don't know, it's all crazy. I'm obsessed with it. I love it. So, like, was it hard to, like, were you on a pump at this time or no? I can't remember if that's
what. No, I was on shots, but I wasn't on a CGM yet. So I was still doing finger sticks.
Okay. I was going to say, I can't imagine like trying to maneuver having like
no.
a tubing pump in costumes like that.
So there's a couple interesting things with diabetes in this particular thing. The first was because I was on finger sticks and I was playing an alien. I have a friend, Doug Jones, who you guys might know as like the fish from Shape of Water. He plays an alien on the show, and they put him in prosthetic gloves, which are not like regular gloves. They're things you can't really take on and off. And I remember sitting on set across from him, and I was going to be on the show, and I thought, if they put me in these gloves, I'm screwed because I'm not going to be able to test. I'm going to have somebody do it for me on my arm. It's just going to be a nightmare. And I talked to people and they were just like, just tell costumes. It'll be fine. So I told costumes. I said, look, is there anything we can do? Can we paint my hands blue? And they're like, I don't know. And then they just said, well, let's just put you in black gloves the whole time. So the whole time I'm in the show, in every scene, in a scene where I'm eating, I'm just wearing like black leather gloves for no reason. And it's just because they were like, well, let's just put him in gloves so he can check his blood sugar whenever he needs to. So that was one diabetes thing that I dealt with there. And then the other diabetes thing was that I was so worried about going high mask, because the mask is basically a huge piece of rubber that is glued to every surface of your face. It's like a torture technique. It's maybe the most uncomfortable thing, you know, out that is legally you're able to do to another person. It's really is awful. And I was so worried about going high that I was just like, for the times that I was shooting, I was just insane about blood sugar control. So I was barely eating throughout the day. And if I was eating, it was just extremely low carb. And it was only sustainable for a short amount of time. Obviously, a month or without any breaks in between, I would have had to come up with another plan. But because it was just a short, sort of these short bursts, that's kind of how I decided to deal with it. And it was just like a weird actor thing, you know? It was like, well, I'm just not really going to eat throughout the day, so that way I can keep my blood sugar stable, so I don't feel like I need to rip this torture mask off my face.
Did you have any, like, other troubles with diabetes, like, in terms of, like the rules and regulations around you on set? Were there any, like, problems if something did happen?
No, you know, I didn't really tell anybody because they didn't need to know, you know? If something were to go wrong, I could just ask for a juice box or something like that. I had a little bag of stuff that had all my stuff in it. And I was in such tight control, you know, obsessively tight control, that I never really felt like I was in danger or that I was, you know, something bad was going to happen. I think if I had to do something that would have put me in danger, I would have told somebody. But, you know, I didn't really tell anybody. It was kind of a need to know basis.
Yeah, that's understandable. I feel like, you know, it's a lot of stuff is moving around and a lot of stuff is happening. So,
and a lot of the time, you know, I'm sure people have experience of this at other jobs, not just as an actor, but you tell somebody and in their attempt to help you, they just make things 1,000 times worse. And so I just wanted to avoid that. I don't know if anybody else has had that experience, but, you know, you tell somebody and they go out of their way to try and help you without really consulting you properly. And it just winds up making things worse. And even if they mean well.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. It can be, like, you know, they mean well, but it can just be more of a hassle sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you and your wife, were both on the show. Did you get to work a lot with her?
We got to do a couple of scenes together, which was amazing. We had so much fun. Jonathan Frakes was directing us, who plays Riker in TNG. And so that was a lot of fun because he knew we were married. Yeah, that was just really just a fun thing to get to do. And especially fun because I was in such crazy makeup. So it just made it kind of silly and fun and exciting.
That does sound like a lot of fun.
No, I have to ask, yes. Did you ever get to sit in the captain's chair? And is it as intimidating?
Oh my God, of course I did. I was sitting in the captain's chair the moment I got to set year one.
I remember Will Wheaton on an episode of The Ready Room saying that it was intimidating for him to like go sit because it's kind of like an area that everyone avoids. I just wondered.
Well, you know, what I started doing very early, way before I got cast, is I realized that if I made friends with everybody and just sort of looked like I was supposed to be there, I could wander around every set and nobody would say anything to me. So day after day, I would just wander onto the bridge and sit in the chair just because I could. So I got used to it.
Fair enough.
That's so cool. And nobody just, they're just like, yeah, all right, it's cool.
They've got other things to worry about.
So my final question, after being, you know, kind of in this area, did you meet anybody else who was a type one in, like the Star Trek universe or just like filming in general?
You know, I haven't met a ton. I didn't meet a ton of type ones. It's pretty rare it was rare in the entertainment industry. I think it's becoming less rare. One of our sound guys, Sean, who will be doing on-set sound, a sound mixer for type one. His son is type one diabetic, so we got to connect on that, and that was really special. That's really all from on-set, on that particular set. You know, since then, I've obviously gotten to interact with a lot of other type one actors, especially a lot of like younger up and coming actors, which has been really, really wonderful for me and probably okay for them, maybe.
Thank you so much for talking with me and answering my questions about this. I, like I said, I'm obsessed with stuff like that, so I think it is so cool. But I'm going to pass it on to Tom to talk about the film and all that.
Great stuff, guys, absolutely loving the chat. So let's talk about your film, Noah.
Yeah,
what is the film about, and how long have you been working on this project to kind of get it going?
So February and March of 2020 I was doing a play in Baltimore, and there was this, I was doing it with a really talented deaf actor named Trishelle Edmonds. And she was so gracious and so kind in sort of, you know, just like letting me peek my head into the deaf community, and talking to me about what that community is like, what it means to her and to other deaf people, how complex and how ultimately like how important it is. And in talking to her, I really just felt that pull that I think a lot of diabetics feel, which is like a real need for community. And in this play, I was playing a dog, and I had like 40-minute stretches where I just laid on the floor. And so I would just sit there and think and sort of stare at the ceiling. And this idea for this movie just sort of popped in my head. I don't really know how it got there, but it just sort of popped in my head. And I thought I should really, really write this thing. And then, like, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks later, it's locked down in New York. It's, you know, really scary times and also a lot of free time. And I got up every morning for like a month and I wrote what is almost essentially the shooting script, which is the story of a man and his wife who sort of leave an unspecified disaster and go on a sort of hike, a journey, in hopes of finding a cache of insulin before it's too late. That's kind of the gist of the story and where it came from, and just sort of that need to feel like the need to engage myself artistically with the a diabetes community, I think.
Yeah, I think that's incredible, that whole experience, the inspiration of working with Trishelle kind of motivated you and inspired you to go on to do it. And from that moment of you playing a dog and you had that time just looking at the ceiling and inspired you to do it. Incredible. So, and also I guess being a type 1 diabetic yourself, it was an even more motivation factor to write it and be in the film and be part of that journey yourself, rather than, I guess, someone else doing it who maybe not able to articulate that portrayal of type 1 diabetes as we may know it, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's so many, like, at the end of the day, it's going to be a short film. Some people will like it. Some people will hate it. Some people will be moved by it. Some people will think it's silly. You know, whatever, but there is so much sort of bubbling within it for me. You know, one of the main things is sort of both the lack of representation, but also the history of representation, both of diabetes and disability in movies, particularly in like disaster or survival dramas. If you guys remember the episode of The Walking Dead, where they find a type 1 diabetic and he's like carrying around his insulin in a cooler. And I just remember thinking, you know, he's dead. He's not carrying around a cooler of insulin 3 years later through the forest. You're dead. And I just remember that feeling of seeing that again and again, where the sense was like, oh, you know, this diabetic person in this piece or whatever, it's not for me. It's for the abled audience. It's for people who need it explained to them. It's for people who need to feel like in a disaster, in a situation, they're going to be the heroes who save the disabled person. And in reality, disabled people save themselves. They advocate for themselves. They fight for themselves. They are the one who save themselves. And they have abled allies. You know, they have people on their team helping them along the way. But I just thought it was really important to put a story out there, both from the type 1 and from the disabled perspective, which is not about, you know, an abled person saving the disabled dead weight, but on two people sort of going through a journey together where, you know, a lot of the time, and I think this is an experience that might resonate for people, a lot of the time with diabetes, with, you know, somebody who is abled, who doesn't have it, you spend a lot of time taking care of them. You have to manage their fears and anxiety. You have to manage how they understand the disease. You have to manage them. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just not something you really ever get to see portrayed in media. And also, you know, you never see a diabetic handling anything to do with diabetes on screen. My hope with this film, among many things, is that diabetics who watch it will feel like this is for them. You know, I'm in good hands with this. This person really is a diabetic. They're not trying to pander to me. And my other hope with that is that people who aren't diabetic who will feel like, I know what this is and this feels good, or people who know a little and want to learn more will really want to lean in and say, that wasn't talking down to me. I feel like I know a little, but I can learn more. And I'm smart enough to learn more about this thing.
And how cool is it to be doing such an amazing film project with your wife as well? Who lives these moments that you're talking about every day. She's there by your side, supporting you or living it. You know what I mean? So how is she feeling about being part of the project?
I think she's excited. I think, honestly, you know, she's been like jumping from project to project. So I think the reality of it is going to hit her a lot harder than she's expecting. Because on the outside, it just looks like two people journeying. But really, it is also another story about like how people manage each other's fears and anxieties in stressful life and death situations like this, even when it's just like in the day to day, you know, how do you manage that, those intrusive thoughts of like, you know, what if the worst were to happen? And then, you know, I'm also just really excited to work with Anthony Rapp, who most people would know as Mark from the original production of Rent. You know, we're really good friends, and I just feel like he cares so much about this movie. He cares so much about getting it right. And, you know, there is just something about lending some, you know, maybe it's superficial, but just some like quote unquote credibility to a disability film, to a diabetes film, you know, lending names to that, that will hopefully make people really pay attention and not just write it off as like, oh, well, this is just for diabetic people or this is just for disabled people, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So obviously you mentioned before that this past week you've been on site location scout and you've been testing the cameras and do some test shots. What's the sort of time scale of the production of the film? Do you have an idea of when it'd be released? And
sure.
And sort of what network will it be released on? I don't know the logistics, but is it in a cinema or through a platform or?
So basically the plan will be to shoot it and then do post-production. Hopefully post-production will be done by the end of July. So it can kind of run the festival circuit. And then you kind of see how it goes on the festival circuit. If a distributor wants it and wants to pick it up, it might go to there. And if a distributor wants to, you know, kind of buy the idea and expand it into something else, it might sort of hang tight for a little bit as something else gets developed. Or if it doesn't hit the festival circuit, or if nobody's interested in purchasing it, then probably, you know, my guess is sometime in 2023, it will just sort of go up on the internet somewhere. And, you know, everybody who backed it on Kickstarter, who will get digital screeners, will, you know, probably get those, hopefully either like right as it's going into festivals or right after it's going into festivals. And then honestly, you know, I don't really care if people like share those.
Yeah. And you touched upon the Kickstarter, obviously. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that and the fundraising behind it? And I saw you got over £88,000 from like 700 odd amazing donors. That's incredible, isn't it?
It was really crazy. It was really inspiring. It was really gratifying, you know, sharing that idea, that sort of what do you do in a apocalypse situation and you probably just, you know, aren't going to make it. That sort of thought resonated with so many people. I was really struck and touched and moved and gratified by how many big donors were people with diabetes who I hadn't interacted with before, or people who knew people with diabetes. And I was just struck by how many diabetics who I hadn't interacted with before participated, reached out to me, you know, shared their stories with me, told me how excited they were. And it just really solidified, you know, how desperately important building our community is, you know, how important stuff like this is to people, and, you know, not just for fun, but for true physical and mental survival. It's desperately important, and something that I've been so happy to see grow, basically, you know, over the last 2 or 3 years, really. And I'm just so excited to see how it's going to continue to grow. And also, you know, part of a way to build community is give people things to talk about, to watch together, to participate in together. And so hopefully this movie, one of its purposes will serve to bring people together in some form, underneath its umbrella, talking about the movie, watching the movie together, disagreeing about it, you know. And also, hopefully it will just be the first of many, not even by me, you know. Hopefully this will just begin more and more, not begin, but continue more, you know, kind of diabetic art, media, storytelling, all that stuff.
It's absolutely incredible, Noah. And hopefully, honestly, we can't wait to see it. And we'll be keeping a watchful eye on all your tweets and the future for it. Final sort of questions for me, really. Obviously, yourself wrote it and you're in it and Mary's in it. And obviously, you mentioned amazing Anthony Rapp. Is there any other sort of actors, actresses that are in the film, or is it more centered around yourself? And when's my invite to join as a extra? I can pack my bag. I'll be over by Wednesday. I'll see you there.
If you want to hop on the plane and start lugging some equipment around, you are more than welcome. We can always need an extra set of hands.
I wish.
It's just the two of us. We do have a woman who reached out to me via the Kickstarter, who's a type 1 diabetic, and she's from England, and she just was like, I need to be a part of this. And I said, okay. And so she's flying out and coming to help us with it. So she did it, you know. So it'll be really nice to have another type 1 diabetic on the set with me. I think that will be really special, because having two of us in one place is just like so rare. So yeah, I'm just really, I'm really excited about it. I hope it turns out well. I hope people like it. And if it winds up being a piece of crap and everybody hates it, it's actually okay, because hopefully people will watch it and be like, this is an absolute piece of crap. I can do this better. And then they will. And that's a win, you know?
For those that missed the Kickstarter, will it be available to like buy or download from somewhere?
I'm not sure. I honestly don't know the sort of distribution plan. It really depends on the reception at film festivals. It's either going to go onto a streaming service, in which case, you know, it'll be like Netflix or Amazon, or it will just go online for free, or something else. I honestly, I haven't really thought much past the 16th, at which point I'm going to, you know, take a 3-day nap. So I don't know, but I promise, as, you know, updates come out, I'll make sure to post about it, and I promise nobody will miss it.
Brilliant stuff, and thank you for the invite. Unfortunately, I don't feel able to make it. I'd love to. Chris, Morgan, doing anything? I know you guys are over that way.
I was just about to say, my college semester is almost over. Where are y'all filming?
We're filming in upstate New York.
Oh, that's a bet. I have a friend that lives there.
Okay, there you go. I mean,
yeah. Sure. With yourself, Mary, and Anthony, and we can kind of showcase the amazing film then, if that's cool with you.
We'll make it happen.
Good man. What
watch
we're doing?
Party. We could have a group watch party.
There we go.
Be a blast.
Yeah, it's a...
There we go. Love it. I know we're coming to our sort of end point to our conversation, really, and I know we're eating into your time, but maybe a last few questions from Chris. He's kind of going to finish the chat, all right?
Sure, and if there's other questions out in the group as well, I'm more than happy to field any of those.
Awesome.
I have a few if I can jump in before Chris.
Go for it.
Anyone you work with regularly, even family or friends that can tell what your sugars are before you or your smart device know what you are? So like, can you, I don't know, your mom, let's say, tell that you're low sugar before you can?
I think my wife can tell when I go high because I'm snotty and a jerk, and she's like, all right, well, I'm leaving you alone for the next hour and a half.
That makes sense. Me too. There's only a few people, but I think I've got a few close friends that can sort of tell it, more when I'm going low than when I'm high. I'm a little more tame when I'm higher.
Yeah, I think it's probably just her.
Fair enough. I'll leave it to you, Chris.
Thanks for jumping in there, Morgan. Or Norman, sorry.
Norman. Thank you.
You've talked about, you talked about the peer support and why it's so important. And actually, I mean, your story about sort of identifying with the deaf community with Gallaudet resonated. I actually lived in D.C. for a while. One of the bars that I hung out with hosted a dart league that was organized through Gallaudet. And it was really cool because you walk into this crowded bar and the entire place is dead silent.
Wow.
It was almost like unnerving to walk in there until you figured out what was going on, and then it was like, oh, okay. But it was really cool to see that community come in together like that. So what do you think about peer support being important, and what are your views on it, and the factors that involve connecting with others?
Yeah, you know, I think about a lot with diabetes, you know, because it is an invisible illness. You know, it doesn't feel invisible. And obviously at times it's extremely visible, but generally, you know, it's very hard to find people in real life to connect with, because everybody is so spread out, and you don't know right away, you know, if somebody has it or if they're even in a place where that they can talk about it, you know? So you don't want to sort of bring something up that somebody is actually trying to kind of keep hidden. But it's just so important. And I think the internet has done such a great job of letting people connect, especially people sort of in the same mindset connect. I'm just excited for this sort of new diabetes community expression and movement to just keep growing. I'm just really excited to see where it might go.
Do you think the invisibility issue might be resolving, I guess, might be the advent of the visible devices that people are wearing, the CGMs and Libres and other
monitors? It
definitely helps.
Yeah, it definitely does help. It definitely does help, you know, especially like with stuff on your arms that you might not have seen before. Yeah, that's actually a really good point. So that does make a difference as well. Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I know, like, if I'm out in public someplace and I see someone with a Dexcom on or a Libre on or something like that, I'll, you know, at least, you know, sort of say hi and wave and show them mine and be like,
yes,
you know, hey, I'm part of the club too.
Yes, I try to do that with everyone I see. And there's like a moment of panic as the person is like, why is this crazy tall man talking to me? And then they're usually generally pretty pleased.
And then also the advocacy stuff is obviously big about publicity and getting the word out about things.
Right.
But, how's your involvement been with advocacy organizations and movements and campaigns?
You know, this sort of all started, the twofold, which was that early on in the pandemic, I spent some time giving out extra insulin I had to people who had lost their job or lost their health insurance. And I just found that to be a very moving experience as well, and a very sad one, because as I would meet people in real life who were so appreciative of this, you know, gift I could give them, it just became so clear that, not that it wasn't clear already, but just having it reinforced that, you know, They didn't do anything wrong, you know, even if they did, it doesn't matter. But it just was, it just really hit me how unfair, especially in the States, the current situation is, and how dangerous and how cruel, truly, deeply cruel it is. So early on when I was on Star Trek, with the help of a bunch of fans, I ran a couple of campaigns. One was just like a please help, and another was like, I'll mail you a picture and a pin. And we raised like $18,000 for T1 International. And, you know, this film, Type One, is in collaboration with T1 International. So my real hope is that you finish watching the movie, you feel connected to this issue, you sort of really grasp the dire situation of what having to ration insulin is, what not having access to insulin really costs on an emotional level. You finish the movie, you see the T1 International credit card come up, and you go and you engage with them. Or you engage with the Insulin for All community. So that way it's not just, there's follow-up for people who suddenly feel really invested in this. So that's hugely important to me. And I think at heart, you know, this film is an Insulin for All film. I think, you know, if it's effective, you'll walk away saying everyone should have access to insulin no matter what. Nobody should have to go through this. And that's one of my true main goals for this movie is, you know, to create a bit of effective, propaganda for insulin for all.
Nothing wrong with propaganda when it's used for good.
Exactly.
The pins that you set out that you mentioned, are those the ones I'm looking at an image right now? It's like the Star Trek communicator with the Delta, but it's got a blue diabetes awareness ribbon with a blood drop on it. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So it was like sort of the Insulin for All division of Starfleet. Some fans 3D printed the original versions, and I sent those out. And then my friend Frag, who's in the chat here, sort of redesigned a version of it. And then I'm getting those custom made into like enamel pins to send out to Kickstarter backers, which I'm really, really excited about.
Very, very cool. That's actually the end of the questions that I had, or at least that I had been assigned by Tom. I guess it's time to ask if there's anybody else out there in the audience who has any questions for Noah, assuming that you're so cool with sticking around and answering a few more.
Sure.
In the meantime, Tom or Morgan, do you guys have any anything that's burning that we didn't get a chance to ask?
I just think it's been such a fascinating chat, and I've learned so much, and I can take away lots and loads of things. And I know next week's guest speaker is Dr. Bob, who is part of the American Diabetes Association, and he is part of the Diabetes Summer Camps, Noah. So it'd be interesting, leading on from what you spoke about today, to get his sort of perspectives and stuff. But honestly, it's been really amazing for you to connect with us and enlighten us with your sort of diabetes journey, and then kind of linking it into your career and what you're doing as well with the advocacy and the film and everything. It's just simply amazing.
Question for you, Noah. Have you thought about what you might do actually in real life if some sort of societal collapse happened, aside from die, obviously, which we would all ultimately do?
That's my answer, man.
I'm thinking like back to Ava Saxel in World War II, where she and her husband managed to actually acquire pancreases from a butcher and extract insulin to keep people alive. I don't know about going to that extreme. I know I've thought about the company that actually developed the tech to make modern insulins has a facility in my town. So I've actually thought about, geez, I might need to go try to stage an armed takeover there to see if I could get insulin production up and running.
You know, I always say that I'll be the guy who early on in the movie, in the regular movie, will like sacrifice himself to the zombies to buy the rest of the crew a little bit more time. So I think I'll be the human shield early on. That's my plan, human shield.
Taking advantage of being a big target.
Exactly. I basically count as three, so that's the plan.
Noah, are you a fan of any other sort of sci-fi shows other than Star Trek?
Not really.
what that's good.
I got a question for Noah.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you get ready to go to work and get ready on a set, like when I'm going to do something, I know it's going to be like, you know, I don't have time to blood test or check. What I'll do is I'll eat something that will hold me over. Like when I go for a bike ride, I'll eat like 3 scrambled eggs because it's got protein in it, but it doesn't take a lot of insulin to maintain that. Do you do the same thing?
Yeah, that was exactly what I would did. I would, you know, I would have to get to set super, super early. So like at 3:30 or 4 in the morning, I'd have a very low carb, high protein breakfast. And then just sort of hope that sustained me for the next 12 to 14 hours, which it usually actually did a fairly decent job with. So yeah, that was exactly the plan. And then basically just, you know, occasionally maybe having a sip of juice if I'm starting to drop or something like that. Or just, you know, if I can see that I'm slowly ticking up because of a lot of protein, you know, maybe taking a unit or two, just really trying to keep it steady at like 115, 110.
Nice. Yeah. I know that feeling. I think we all do.
I'm sure.
Yep.
What's your favorite diabetic friendly food? That doesn't necessarily mean low sugar. You know, maybe it's something that holds you over for a long time, but what's your favorite sort of diabetic friendly food?
Yeah, I feel like eggs are a good low carb food. You know, they're versatile. They're good. You can eat them at multiple times during the day, which is good. That's probably the food I consume the most, which is like, you know, a low carb food. But honestly, no food is truly diabetic friendly. They're all out to get you.
All right. On the other side, what's your favorite treat?
It's also ice cream. there's a reason why I constantly go to ice cream when I'm low, because I'm like, yeah, that's, I'll have that no matter what.
I can't disagree with that. Ice cream's great. Well, okay, what's your favorite ice cream then?
McDonald's. Yeah, McDonald's soft serve. Man, I have that way too often.
Wait, you know of a McDonald's where the ice cream machine works?
Listen, I'm in New York, so I'll scour like 3 or 4 different McDonald's. One of them will work.
Some amazing comments coming through on the hashtag. Renza says, jet lag is good for something. It means I'm awake and can tune into some of this week's diabetes chat. So it's nice to see Renza there. Dree says again, anyone else describe themselves as Borg when someone asks about their CTM?
Yes, I love that. Absolutely. You are a cyborg. We are Borg 100%.
And Miss Diabetes Janina, Noah's right. The diabetes survival film can't be about the abled saving the disabled. We're the experts when it comes to managing this life-threatening condition every day. We're our best chance at survival. Support from non-diabetics is appreciated, though.
Yeah, well said. Well said, yeah. That it really is that feeling of, you know, we are the ones who have to take care of ourselves.
Yes, definitely. So yeah, Ash, you jumped on. Do you want to say hi to Noah and any questions for Noah?
Hi. My name is Ashley. I just was talking to Tom on Twitter a couple days ago, which is a coincidence because it started because a friend of mine and I are making a documentary about diabetes. And so it just worked out that this happened to be the second time I've joined in on this space. And it was about your film, which sounds incredible. My friend and I, we went to film school together, and he's a filmmaker. I'm just the diabetic of the two. And so that's what I wanted, you know, by the diabetics for the diabetics, also, you know, ideally for anyone who will listen. So my question for you, when making your, you know, when writing your film, if there was anything that you, any themes or topics that came up for you that maybe didn't fit into your film that you feel are important, if there's anything that you thought, man, this should be talked about, but it doesn't feel like it fits in this space.
Yeah, you know, I think that's, first off, that's so cool. I love that so much. I think there's a ton of stuff, you know. This film can only be this, like, one thing. It can only hold one thing. And I think, you know, each movie, each article, it can only kind of hold what it can hold. I think there's so many stories out there about people of color's experience. Medical deserts. I think that is like such an important story that I am not able to tell and would love to support somebody in telling that story because I think it's really important. I think that stories about aging with type 1 diabetes and managing your care as you get older are something that I'm really interested in. And I also think that experience of going to a hospital and realizing once you get there that you are your life is in danger often if you go to a hospital and hand your care over to some people there sometimes. Those are things that I think about a lot that this film just kind of couldn't hold. But I just think that there are tons and tons more stories. And of course, there are, you know, all of the insulin rationing, insulin availability, insulin for all stories out there as well.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, aging with diabetes didn't even pop into my head, which is sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's like, am I going to make it that long? Maybe, maybe not. And then, oh man, you know, having seen people get old and trying to imagine how I would manage my care when I am, you know, elderly, is a tough idea to engage with.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I've had the thought pop into my head. At one point, I pictured myself a little, you know, as an 80-year-old woman with an insulin pump on her hip, and that was mm-hmm. like a weird thing to kind of picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for answering my question. If I just could take 1 second.
Please do.
We're at the point in the documentary right now where we are just kind of trying to collect people's perspectives. Because like I said, I know mine. I know what people have shared with me. I don't know the things they haven't shared with me or people I don't know or, you know, people of color, people who are aging. So right now, a link to a form that we created in my Twitter bio. And so if anyone wanted to click on that link and provide any perspective, there's a, you know, we also have the option, would you like to be interviewed? Would you not like to be interviewed? And so that would be awesome if anyone felt so inclined, you know, just trying to tell our story like everyone else on here.
That's awesome. That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, guys. And I think that's the amazing thing, isn't it? In enabling us to have these chats where we can connect with people from all over the world. And thank you, Noah, for coming on tonight and being our guest speaker. It's been absolutely fascinating. But honestly, it's been truly fascinating and amazing. And if anything, just hearing the excitement from Morgan's voice when she was asking the questions, that was just simply an ace.
Well, thank you guys all for having me. I really appreciate being here. I really appreciate you all doing all this hard work to organize and keep this space going. It's really important. And so I really appreciate it. If anybody listening has anything they'd like to follow up with me about, my DMs are open. So you can just kind of hit me up there with anything that's on your mind.
That's awesome.
It's been a pleasure being a part of the conversation today as a first time as well.
I just want to reiterate, thanks so much, Noah, for coming on. It's been awesome. I've been looking forward to this ever since Tom announced that you were booked for today. So,
yes, I'm gonna second that.
I'm glad I lived up to the hype. That's a lot of pressure.
No, it was amazing. Thank you so much. It was
my pleasure, you guys. My pleasure, Morgan. I'm glad I could, you know, facilitate that fan dream for you too.
Thank you.
Noah, maybe one last question, sure. which isn't on my script. What would be your final sort of message to conclude this amazing chat with you this evening for anyone out there with type 1 diabetes, whether you're young or you're not like a teenager, someone who went through that that you did, or any age, because obviously we know diabetes can affect anyone at any age. What's your sort of final message to anyone living with diabetes, or anyone who's a parent or a carer or who works with people with diabetes?
You know, I would say to anybody, wherever you're at, you are doing the best you can and you're keeping yourself alive, and you deserve to be applauded and proud of that, because it is so, so hard. It's so much work, and every hour, every day, every month that you just hang in there through the ups and the downs, you know, you should really appreciate all that it takes in order to do that, because it's no small feat.
I mean, you just summed that up beautifully, mate, honestly. Thank you so much. It's been an honor chatting to you this evening, and we'll all be watching eagerly at what's to come, and we'll see you hopefully in 2023.
Well, I'll keep you posted and stay up to date on my Twitter. I'll try and post lots of pictures from the shoot next week.
Definitely, mate. And I'm just booking my flights. I'll see you Wednesday, all right?
All right. Thank you all so much. I really appreciate it.
See ya. Thank you.
Thanks, Noah.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.